disputes are ever present. And 99% of our disagreements, we resolve outside of court. And I think we paid too little attention to that, given just how routine that kind of dispute resolution is.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Where there's conflict, can outsiders help by creating informal ways for people to resolve their disputes? And does that increase their feelings of security about their lives? Chris Blattman of the Harris School at the University of Chicago, he's one of a team of researchers that has spent many years working on this topic in Liberia. And he joins me now. Chris, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks for having me.
We're focusing on what happened in Liberia today. So let's start off there, shall we? Tell me about Liberia, about 2008 when this intervention started. What had taken place in Liberia? What was the atmosphere like there?
On some level, what was happening there was just what happens in just every country with limited property rights, which is that households have land disputes. It's a dispute over a border between our land, or an inheritance dispute, or who really deserves this market plot, which are really high stakes. You know, it's people's most important asset. But what was different about Liberia is that they had just emerged from a 14-year civil war, and that had collapsed institutions. A lot of the normal courts and things that might adjudicate these things weren't working. Of course, they're often not working in places without war, but it was certainly worse. But many people had to leave their land and then come back. And so just the number of these disputes were magnified by that political instability, even though by the time I was visiting some of these villages, that instability was 6 years in the past.
As often happens in these cases, I guess, the war officially ends, but the things that gave rise to the conflict, well, a lot of them are still there hanging around.
And it could have been a flood, or it could have been a dry spell. There's so many things that interrupt and move people around in lower income countries. And that's why these ever-present disputes and dispute resolution is just like such a core issue for villages and states.
This work is about informal institutions to help resolve those disputes. Now, when we hear about institutions, when we learn about institutions in economics, we tend to think of the rule of law and systems of courts. This isn't what this is about at all, is it?
I mean, those are important too, but we have to remember that, as in any place, probably, you know, disputes are ever present. And 99% of our disagreements, we resolve outside of court. And we do that through ourselves negotiating, you know, with our neighbors. We do that through maybe an influential community leader, or a big man or a big woman, or our priest or minister or somebody. And I think we paid too little attention to that, given just how routine that kind of dispute resolution is.
So think back to this. As a very young researcher, you must have been. You helped in a program to train people in alternative dispute resolution.
Yeah.
Why is that useful in this context? How does alternative dispute resolution work?
I didn't even realize at the outset what it was, because like a lot of NGO programs, this one was originated in UNHCR and a local NGO, well, international, but locally owned NGO called the Justice and Peace Commission.
Yeah.
And they called it peace education, which just, I don't know, it's one of these buzzwords. And what does it even mean? And it took me some time to realize that actually everything they were doing, it's a really common set of principles of better dispute resolution, but alternative dispute resolution, ADR, was codified in the United States and exported around the world as this really great general purpose technology. And it's just a set of practices for getting things out of court and helping people establish some ground rules for the dispute, for controlling their emotions, for not getting angry, from understanding the other person's point of view, to trying to find common ground. It's basically like a social technology that seems to be really, really, really effective everywhere it's been implemented in a qualitative way, but it hadn't really ever been, to my knowledge, very rigorously studied.
So if you and I have a disagreement about something, do we resolve it amongst ourselves, or other people get involved? What happens?
The techniques of alternative dispute resolution can help you and me. I think of it as a skill and a technology, right? We acquire it, and therefore we're better at negotiating. Then we also might have a third party that helps. Those are mediators, right? So it's also the thing that mediation does. And so like, let me give two concrete examples. One is that you might actually try to establish a set of norms that everybody understands, common knowledge, say in the village, that this is a legitimate institution or decision that you're both going to abide by. And hence, if it doesn't go your way, if you try to deviate from that and forum shop and go find somebody else to relitigate, you're going to face social sanctions and disapproval, and that's going to keep you from defecting. And so it's solving a commitment problem that's really, really common. Mm-hmm. It's also trying to promote mutual understanding. It's trying to get you to see things from the other's perspective, to provide some structure to the dialogue, partly so that you don't have such a distorted view of the other side's point of view, and also so that you maybe are less prone to lose your temper and have other emotional reactions. And so I think it's tackling a lot of the behavioral biases and misperceptions that interfere with conflict resolution.
And the precise norms, for example, that are involved in this, that matters less than the idea that the group reaches a consensus on them.
Correct. The way that alternative dispute resolution is often different than a court system is a court says you're right, you're wrong. I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but there's a winner and a loser. Yes. And alternative dispute resolution sort of looks at this more as a spectrum and recognizes what economists know since Coase and all these other strategists, that there's a bargaining range between two positions. And the whole point of ADR is to stop the bargaining failures that keep you from finding a solution in that range, and then either never resolving that conflict so that it goes on for several years, which is what often happened. When we arrived, there were disputes that were just had been on there for 10 years or longer. But more importantly, that stops you from being violent. And that was a big problem in these villages, that maybe one in five households had a dispute over land, which was huge. But then something like one in five or one in four of those disputes at some time in the past had been violent. And often that meant just a punch in the nose or trampled property. But occasionally, in more than one instance that we worked on, it meant the machetes came out and maybe it turned into like an ethnic conflict in that village between side A and side B. And so there was a real danger that some of these things were not just interpersonally violent, but really escalated.
You went back 1 year after this very high stakes intervention to find out if it had worked. What were the results then?
We saw two things. First of all, the number of disputes hadn't really changed, which is kind of what you expect. There's always disputes. We're always having disagreements. But the number of disputes that went on forever, by which I mean several years, had fallen. And indeed, like a lot of the stock of unresolved disputes, they'd come to some kind of resolution. People were reaching bargains faster, which is great. The second thing is that those disputes were almost a third less likely to result in threats, anger, and violence. Those punches in the nose, that trampled property. And in those very rare instances, something not as statistically significant, because they're so rare, larger incidents of violence. So the disputes were conducted and ended more amicably.
And where we reach with this paper is you're looking more at the long run aspects of this, going back a few years later. So has this persisted? Has the improvement carried on?
Yeah, I don't know. I love to go back after 10, and I'm planning to go back after 20 years on something. So I think of this as maybe medium run. I think that we no longer saw this decrease in the stock of unresolved disputes. I think that initial intervention just helped clear out the closet to some degree, and then the closet was empty. So maybe that's not so surprising. But we continued to see this reduction in these threatening and violent disputes by roughly similar proportion. And maybe the good news is that the number of disputes that were coming up were fewer, right? So because Liberia at this point is starting to look more like a normal country, a lot of these things that related to the war had been resolved. But nonetheless, as Liberia became more normal, even those normal disputes tended to sort of get out of hand sometimes. And essentially, this was a technology that seemed to have lasted. People, both individuals negotiating with one another and people mediating, had basically entrenched these skills and mindsets and norms, and were better at bargaining.
So what we have is a situation, like any situation, where there is always a potential for disputes, but fewer of those disputes were escalating into violence. ADR's clearly working here. What do we know about the mechanisms? What do we know about the fundamental problems that it's solving that are the problems that tend to lead to violence?
This was actually a really eye-opening study for me to do, because I'm sort of a political scientist and economist, and I study conflict. You learn in papers about all the roots of war between nations, and this perspective that I think political economy brings of war as a bargaining failure. And that happens because of there's these sort of more quote-unquote rationalist views that say it's partly because of asymmetric information and it's partly because of commitment problems. I think there's another view that we underappreciate, that it's because of essentially an agency problem, that the people who get to decide whether to use violence are essentially unaccountable for some of the costs, so they ignore them and maybe they're too ready to use violence for private interest. Mm-hmm. And then what I think psychologists talk about, but economists, political scientists talk about less, is either bargaining failures that come from our values, the times when ideology or some intangible incentive, anger, revenge, that we're willing to pay the price of war to fight. And then there's this whole sort of class of quote-unquote irrational or behavioral reasons that we misperceive the situation. And I think what this ADR is doing is it's tackling some of these things. It's trying to reduce asymmetric information by creating norms, but also tools of dialogue. It's trying to solve commitment problems by making it more difficult to defect from a deal over time. Mm-hmm. And it's really trying to change those misperceptions and some of those behavioral passions and reactions and rationality. It's actually trying to make people in a dispute act a little bit more like the rational agents in our models. And it was enlightening to me because it set me on this 10-year path to writing a book about this called Why We Fight, which is mm-hmm. talking about these five ways that bargains break down and how nations going to war and ethnic groups going to war and political factions going to a civil war and villages having these conflicts and then individuals having a fight. All these are incredibly different and we usually analyze them separately, but there's some commonalities of why violence happens, why bargains break down, and we can look at them through this lens and I think just learn a lot from them. So that was maybe for me what was most important about this peculiar little peace education thing that I got pulled into.
I was thinking about this when I was at the UN University wider conference called The Puzzle of Peace. And there is a pervasive critique of peace building, which says it's too top down, that peace is considered to be established when two powerful men shake hands, but you have to build from the bottom up because that agreement doesn't exist in villages. But how do we put the two of those together? Because they both have to exist. What you're saying is they do exist on a continuum.
Yeah. If we live in an unequal society, as so many do, and we have powerful political factions who are dominated by elites with most of the money and most guns, and they're usually men, then we do need the powerful men to shake hands. So yeah. I don't want to discount that because I actually think that's fundamental. And that's kind of the darker side of peace. It's these quasi-corrupt deals that have to be made between warlords and strongmen and such. Where the bottom-up comes into play, I think, is in two ways that I think we don't appreciate. One is that there is this agency problem. Like if for some reason the leaders who are shaking hands do not have the support of the populace, it's going to be hard to maintain that peace. The more important one is where there's sort of other literal strongmen and local warlords and local power brokers. We call those splinter groups and spoilers, and they keep the war going, even though the top level is trying to make a deal.
Yeah.
And for a game theorist, that's end player bargaining. There isn't necessarily an easy peaceful equilibrium in that situation. I want everybody to be empowered and I want everybody to be bought into peace, but actually that's not the hindrance. The hindrance is all of these mini warlords who can really disrupt the larger peace by pursuing their own agendas.
To get back to Liberia on your medium term results. One of the benefits of peace is that people can get on with their lives again. They can start investing in their future because they feel more secure. Is there evidence from alternative dispute resolution that this is an outcome?
So certainly in theory, when it's easier to resolve disputes, that should translate into better property rights. I should feel more comfortable with my land. So I think we anticipated that maybe we'd see people feeling more secure, that they might have more improvements on their land, that they might do things like capital investments, or they might be more willing to leave their land fallow, you know, for longer, which is important for replenishing the land, but that a lot of people in these weak property rights regimes don't do because they worry about losing it if they're not using it. And to our surprise, we didn't see that. And I don't know why. If anything, we saw a slight weakening of this. And so to me, this is one of the puzzles. It wasn't especially strong, but things certainly didn't move in the opposite direction. And they sort of weakly moved in the wrong direction in terms of people feeling more secure. One hypothesis we have, and the data is a little bit consistent with this, but it's hard to pull apart, is that this insecurity came from people who were less connected to political power in those villages. Mm. This goes back to the fact that most societies are quite concentrated power, and this is true at a village as well. In a lot of villages, and a lot of West Africa is no exception, the chief and other authorities allocate land. And you don't have property title, right? It's sort of, you might have some customary rights, but you have rights if it's allocated towards you. And so it's possible that some of this ADR also just basically strengthened that centralized power and made some people more secure if they're connected to that power, but some people less secure. So that was one of the little warning flags we had, a reminder that every supposedly impartial development intervention is probably changing political power in hard to observe ways. And so maybe there was a slight adverse effect in that respect. But that's, like I said, that's just a hypothesis.
There just isn't enough resource for peace building at the moment. There's not enough money. It costs nothing to talk. So is this alternative dispute resolution, is it a free lunch in economic terms?
This intervention certainly wasn't, because it was incredibly costly to go and impart these skills in the manner in which it was done. So they sent these ADR specialists to these villages to train lots and lots of people. Any kind of cost-benefit analysis, which we do in the paper, says, well, great technology, maybe not the most efficient way to deliver it.
Yeah.
I do think there are ways to deliver this at scale. We already do this. I mean, my son and daughter's kindergarten curriculum is actually imbued with socio-emotional skills. And a lot of these skills of conflict resolution and ADR are taught in our school curricula. And they're skills and norms that I think some societies have developed and imbued. And so I do think that embedding some of these in school curricula is a cheap way to go. I do think that embedding these in social media or soap operas and other kinds of media campaigns, radio, there's lots of ways to deliver these. That we've definitely seen lots of social norms marketing around peace and harmony be really, really effective at scale using things like radio and entertainment. And I do think that could be a great way to make these general purpose technologies more general.
Well, we know how to do it. Let's hope that it happens. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The paper we've been talking about is called Engineering Informal Institutions: Long-Run Impacts of Alternative Dispute Resolution on Violence and Property Rights in Liberia. And the authors are Alexandra Hartman, Robert Blair, and Christopher Batman. And also Chris's book, it's called Why We Fight. It covers all of the things that we've been talking about and a lot more as well. I can guarantee whatever your specialization is, you'll learn a lot from it. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. Go on, do it now. And all our past episodes are at voxdev.org, where you'll also find articles about the papers we feature.